The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
A Festivus for the rest of us!
Yes, it is Festivus! Welcome to it, everybody! A Festivus for the rest of us! And I know you're saying, maybe, if you're of a certain age, you may not know what Festivus is. So, Frank Costanza, do tell, what is Festivus?
Many Christmases ago, I went to buy a doll for my son.
Yeah?
I reached for the last one they had. But so did another man.
Oh.
As I rained blows upon him, I realized there had to be another way.
Ah.
What happened to the doll?
It was destroyed.
Oh.
But out of that, a new holiday was born. A Festivus for the rest of us.
When George was growing up, his father hated all the commercial and religious aspects of Christmas, so he made up his own holiday.
And another piece of the puzzle falls into place.
All right.
And instead of a tree, didn't your father put up an aluminum pole?
Jerry, stop it.
And then weren't there feats of strength that always ended up with you crying?
I'm going to watch. You happy now?
Okay. Well, it is Festivus, and we like to take some of the elements of Festivus and keep the tradition going every year. So we will have the airing of the grievances with a slight change. Yesterday, I said that you could call in and air your own grievances. Well, this might be a grievance for you. I'm not going to have time for that today because we have an extended segment for the feats of strength. The feats of strength today will be provided by the one and only Stephanie Kelton. In case you're not familiar, Stephanie Kelton is the author of this brilliant book called The Deficit Myth, Modern Monetary Theory and the Birth of the People's Economy. And given what has happened in the last day or so with Donald Trump saying he's going to veto the COVID relief bill and he got everything wrong, it's like because he wants $2,000 checks sent to you and me instead of the measly $600. No, he doesn't, by the way, but just let's go with it for a moment. You know, Republicans are screaming, deficit, we can't afford that. Well, yes, we can. And so that's Stephanie Kelton's feat of strength today. She will explain exactly how we can afford it, how that all works. And it is a feat of strength because I certainly am no student of economics. As I told her, and I've said over and over again, the one thing I know about money is how to spend it. But when you start talking about supply side economics and trickle down and stuff like that, my eyes roll back in my head. But Stephanie Kelton must be a great professor because when she speaks, I understand what she's saying. She writes that way, too. So if you're interested in this stuff, you should definitely check out her book, The Deficit Myth. Anyway, because it is the holidays, we taped the interview at 1 o'clock this afternoon, so 4 hours ago, and it went longer than I thought it would. So I've got a lot of territory to cover. So bear with me. We got a lot of stuff to get to today and a lot of grievances. And you know what? If I could play music on this show without being copyright violated, I probably would have opened today's program with the Talking Heads burning down the house, because that's what Donald Trump is trying to do. Just about 90 minutes ago or so, the news broke that Trump vetoed the National Defense Authorization Act. Why? Not because of the horrendous war machine it supports with billions of our tax dollars, but because it includes a provision to rename all the military bases and installations honoring traitors to this country. In this case, it includes a provision to, the people who fought against the Union. So there's that. He doesn't want to do away with Fort Hood and other places named for again, traitors to the country. The other part he's mad about is that the NDAA does not repeal Section 230, which has nothing to do with national defense or anything else with this bill. It provides protections for social media companies for what users post on their sites. And the interesting thing about this is that if Section 230 didn't exist, if social media companies, let's talk Twitter for a second. If Twitter was not held harmless for the things that its users posted, if they were held responsible for, say, the things that Donald Trump posted, he would have been banned from Twitter a long time ago. So, you know, this is an instance of trying to cut off his nose to spite his face, but he's too stupid to realize that. So, it's amazing. As much as I hate seeing so much of our tax dollars going to fund these forever wars, this is probably not the best way to go about cutting the defense or offense budget. Not that that's what he's trying to do, but that would be the result of this. And I know what you're thinking. It's what I was thinking. The NDAA passed both houses of Congress with huge margins, veto-proof margins. Well, now some people in the Senate, Lindsey Graham, in the House, you know, the Trumper caucus, the idiot caucus, they're all saying, well, maybe we should vote to repeal Section 230. So who knows what's going to happen? And you know what? If it wouldn't put our troops in danger, you know, they wouldn't get paid. If we don't fund the National Defense Authorization Act, all of those people don't get paid. And sorry, we need to take care of them. They're spread all over the world, ostensibly on our behalf. We need to do right by them. So, yes, this is a grievance. It's a big grievance. And again, another grievance is that I have a year's worth of grievances to air while we air our grievances. But because of the Donald Trump's nonsense over the past 24 hours, I won't have time to get those in. Again, because I have a new batch of grievances stemming from what he's done since we last met yesterday. Unbelievable. And again, I have to do it quickly because the Stephanie Kelton interview runs long. So here's what we're going to do before I get into the rest of my grievances. We'll gather some of our complaints about the year 2020, because I know that comprises a lot of our grievances, into one video. And this is a brand new video courtesy of a new friend of the show. You might recall last week, I think it was last week, I played a parody of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah, which is renamed Trump's a Loser, by a guy named Philip Markle, although on Twitter he's at Philip Sparkle. And yesterday dropped a brand new video with the help of his crew, who are all brilliant. And so we'll let them sort of take care of the 2020 grievances with this one, all right? It is called... Now, that's what I call 2020. Take it away, Philip Markle. Sparkle, here we go.
Are you ready for this year to be over? Now? Now, that's what I call 2020 delivers you this year's chart-bottoming hits.
Oops, I've unheard again. I let out a fart and blamed a good friend. Oh, Jared, Jared, oops, I just flashed my can.
Sorry.
At a hot dog man. I'm not that innocent.
And just in time for the holiday season, we're here to remind you that Melania hates Christmas.
With a Melania Stole Christmas.
You're a mean one, Melania Trump. Salam of corn. Your coat is made of reindeer. Your husband is a troll, Melania Trump. You wouldn't let Donald touch you with his 3.5-inch pole.
And let's not forget the miracle on Pennsylvania Avenue that saved your leader from certain doom.
Regeneron, 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 Regeneron.
This album is 24 hours long and includes a New Year's Eve countdown by Rudy Giuliani and Kimberly Guilfoyle. Because, let's face it, this year needs to end.
now!
But don't tune out after the clock strikes 12, because 2021 needs you to pivot to those two Georgia Senate races.
Whatever Stacey wants, Stacey gets
Starbucks gift cards
and Georgia peaches. Stacey Abrams wants you for round two.
And
move, Mitch, get out the way. Get out the way, Mitch, get out the way.
Now that's what I call a Georgia runoff. To order now, that's what I call 2020. Send check or money order to John Ossoff and Reverend Raphael Warnick.
Do it.
Yeah.
Please.
Must be 18 or older to vote.
Oh, yeah.
Move, Mitch. Get out the way. Get out the way, Mitch. Get out the way.
There you go. It was the Demon Rats, along with our friend Philip Markle, or at Philip Sparkle. I will post the video on the blog at NicoleSandler.com /12-23-20, along with today's show. How great was that? New friend of the show, Philip, you rock. And Demon Spawn, or whoever you are, you guys are, that was excellent. Thank you for that. So a little bit of the grievance that is 2020. But we've got to move along because there's a lot of stuff to get to. So not only did Trump veto the NDAA, but last night he threatened to veto the COVID relief bill that they just passed. Yeah. And he posted this video. There was like 15 minutes of him lying his ass off, not to be confused with Ossoff, his ass off again about the election that he keeps insisting was fixed. It's a fraud. It wasn't any of those things, but you know, he's delusional. So after that, there was a 4-minute segment in which he called the $900 billion coronavirus relief package a disgrace, saying it was full of wasteful spending, that it failed to meet the needs of millions of Americans, and he threatened not to sign it unless it changed. Now, I agree with some of what he said. He said instead of $600, we should all be getting $2,000. But what's obvious is that he's confusing the COVID relief bill with the $1.2 trillion omnibus spending bill, because that's what has all these other things in it. The COVID, the $900 billion COVID bill is not enough. I agree with that. But it doesn't have the frivolous stuff. That's all in the omnibus bill that had to be passed to fund the government, to keep the government running. There's a temporary bill right now, good through Monday night. That's when the government shuts down if he doesn't do it. So... it's just a mess because he's a fucking mess. So Trump called on Congress to increase the individual checks from $600 to $2,000, saying the initial figure was ridiculously low. But of course, he didn't acknowledge that that figure came from his Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin. Of course not. Now, Nancy Pelosi said via Twitter that Republicans had, quote, repeatedly refused to say what amount the president wanted for direct checks. At last, the president agreed to $2,000, so let's do it. So she's now planning to bring it to a vote Thursday, tomorrow. I guess that's Christmas Eve. And that she hopes to pass by unanimous consent. Problem is, Republicans are playing this stupid game and they won't go along with it. Ay, ay, ay. So again, to recap, Donald Trump's team, led by Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, helped negotiate the COVID relief bill deal. White House officials are on record saying that Trump would sign it. After the House and Senate both passed it by huge, again, veto-proof majorities, 359 to 53 in the House, 92 to 6 in the Senate, Trump now speaks up, calls it a disgrace, and demands it be amended. That's a grievance for you. But wait, there's more. And again, from the last 24 hours, here's my latest grievance. He's abusing the power of the pardon. Now, he's done it before, but this is getting ridiculous. He pardoned or gave clemency to 20 people. All right. Among them are George Papadopoulos and Alex Van der Zwaan. those names sound familiar, right? Both of them were convicted, and I think both pleaded guilty to lying to Robert Mueller's team in the investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 election, which, of course, Donald Trump has called a hoax, right? So he pardoned them. He also pardoned three former Republican congressmen who were convicted of fraud: Duncan Hunter, Chris Collins, and Steve Stockman. Pretty heinous individuals. So he's not pardoning people who are wrongly convicted. He's pardoning the scum of the earth. Two Border Patrol agents convicted of shooting an undocumented immigrant and covering it up. One guy who I thought Rick Scott, our governor, was the largest perpetrator of Medicare fraud in the country. But actually, there's somebody else who was convicted. Rick Scott only took the fifth 75 times in a court case against him. I guess they couldn't prove it. But this other guy, whose name I can't remember, was in jail for, I mean, billions of dollars for defrauding the government in Medicare fraud. And Donald Trump pardoned him. And the media is not talking about that one. Listen out for that, because there's something there. But the worst of the bunch is Donald Trump pardoned four military contractors who were all working for Blackwater. Remember Blackwater? The company so bad they had to rename it G, and then who knows, rename it again. This is Eric Prince's mercenary force. These four were convicted because they were of their involvement in a deadly shooting of Iraqi civilians. 14 people were killed. At least 17 more were gunned down in a bloody, horrible massacre in Baghdad in 2007. One of them had been sentenced to life in prison, 2 to 15 years, and the fourth one to just under 13 years. The Department of Justice went to great lengths to prosecute these men. And Donald Trump basically just said that committing war crimes is fine by him. He is pardoning war criminals, and he's not even close to done yet. That's a grievance, and we should all be freaked out about it. I don't have time, but there's a heartbreaking thread on Twitter that I will link to from the blog today that you can read about one of the people that one of these murderers who Donald Trump pardoned killed. It's just, it's horrific. It's disgusting. It makes my blood curdle. I'm so, so angry. And on top of that, you know, Christmas is 2 days away, and I'm not a Christmas celebrator, but I've sent some gifts to people, and I've been sending out paintings because I am selling some paintings. And I'll tell you what, it may be too late to get a new gift, but if you have a pet lover in your immediate circle and want to give them a wonderful gift, I'm doing pet portraits, and we can send a certificate good for a custom pet portrait, and it can get there in seconds. So if you're interested, send me an email, Nicole@NicoleSandler.com, and I'll talk to you about it. But the Postal Service is fucked up, and that was obviously by design. So I'm going to share with you another grievance, this one by way of a poem from Jeff Hauser. He was on the show a few weeks ago. He's from the Revolving Door Project, and they're riding herd over Biden's cabinet picks. But here's a poem that they wrote, he and some of his colleagues at the Revolving Door Project, that fits in with the theme for today. 'Twas the week before Christmas, and all through D.C. no lawmakers were stirring, not even Speaker Nancy. Yet a crisis was brewing all across the land. The post office was struggling to keep up with demand. The stockings weren't hung, as they'd been delayed. The Republicans didn't care. They were still getting paid. Democrats wouldn't fight to get children their toys. And so Christmas was stolen by Louis DeJoy. Yeah. I wonder if we have time. Real quickly, there's a PSA that's really important that you should hear. This is a real PSA. So, here we go. It needs no introduction. We'll just go.
As we wrap up this year and head into the next, we invite you to give a big fuck you to 2020.
But not just any fuck you, a fuck you for a cause. Let's start with a giant fuck you COVID-19.
Fuck you for taking my job. Sorry. furloughing my job.
Furloughing? Fuck you.
Fuck you for closing his school.
Yeah, fuck you.
Fuck you for canceling our wedding.
Fuck you to the toilet paper hoarders.
Fuck you to all the people in 2020 who said all lives matter.
All lives will fucking matter when black lives fucking matter.
Fuck you, Derek Chauvin.
And a double fuck you to the killers of Breonna Taylor.
Arrest those fuckers.
Speaking of murderers, fuck you, murder hornets.
Murder what?
Murder hornets.
That's a thing?
I've had it with these motherfucking Zoom calls on this motherfucking computer.
Fuck you, New Zealand. You think you're better than us? Well, you are, but fuck you anyway.
I don't care who you voted for. Fuck this guy.
Fuck you, Karen.
Fuck you, Karen.
Fuck you, Karen.
2020, fuck you.
Fuck you for taking RBG.
And Kobe.
And John Lewis.
Fuck you for taking my grandmother.
2020, fuck you!
This year, everyone could do with a little extra help. Text fuck you to 1-877-EFFTHIS. And here's to a happier, healthier 2021. It's real.
As we wrap up,
I am so excited that our next guest was available to join us today, because you finally finished grading all your papers. You're done for the semester, and you're on your own for the holidays now, or sort of, kind of. Stephanie Kelton?
Listen, yes. It's the best feeling when you get through the finals and all the grades have been uploaded and you just, reach that point. So, yes, I got there yesterday just in the nick of time. You know, always come in right under the deadline, and then there's that just sigh of relief. So, yeah, now it's just a winter break. Kids are home with us now for a little bit of a stretch, and we'll see what happens with the pandemic and whether there's some in-person schooling, or you never know, given the numbers and the way the district might respond, but we're together.
And that's the important thing, and it's good that you can be together, because a lot of families can't be right now, but this is what we have to go through. So hopefully next year we will be able to be with bigger gatherings, and we got to get out of 2020, because this has just been an insane year. So Stephanie Kelton is here to talk about things other than the pandemic, and actually as a professor, you teach economics and public policy at Stony Brook University on Long Island. Your latest book is The Deficit Myth. I've got it right here. Modern Monetary Theory and the Birth of the People's Economy. Oh, we've got a screenshot up there. You are one of the leading authorities on modern monetary theory. And I always talk about you as somebody who is able to explain economic policy in a way that even I can understand, and that's saying a lot, because I, as I've said often, the only thing I'm good at with money is spending it. But if you had to explain to somebody who didn't know, you say MMT, they say, what is that? How do you explain it to them?
Oh, telling the truth about the way our monetary system works and the mechanics of government finance, what government can afford and why and how it all works. The book is called The Deficit Myth. Mm-hmm. I think we've probably talked about this before, that, even though it's the singular in the title, The Deficit Myth, that there isn't just one myth. There are a slew of myths and misconceptions and misunderstandings, and I think sometimes just outright lies about the way that the monetary system works, right? Why is the federal government different from the rest of us? What makes it possible for Congress to spin out multi-trillion dollar spending bills at a time when the bottom is falling out of the economy, when governors and mayors can't do that, when businesses can't do that, when struggling families and workers can't just come up with money? How is it that the federal government, everybody's pointing their finger at Congress and saying, you have to do something. Why? What is it about Congress that makes it uniquely capable of discharging, right, of putting dollars out there and getting them into the hands of struggling businesses and families and so forth, when the rest of us don't have any money? Where's it all coming from? So this book attempts to kind of get at the answer, to help people understand why the federal government isn't like the rest of us. The first chapter of the book is called Don't Think of a Household. because we're constantly told, you know, well, the government's got to balance its budget. It can't just run these deficits all the time. This is irresponsible. And so it just tries to break through many of the myths and misunderstandings and give people a better understanding of, you know, how it all works.
And in terms of how it all works, you know, to the Republicans, you know, the one thing I've learned in following politics for the last few decades is when they're in power, deficits and the national debt doesn't seem to matter to them. But when a Democrat is in the White House, then that's all they care about. Then all of a sudden, it's like, we can't spend any money. The deficit, the debt. And in fact, we saw that during these Trump years, they passed this huge tax break for billionaires to the tune of well over $1 trillion. That was no problem. But now we're in the middle of this pandemic. People are hurting like never before, certainly not in my lifetime. And there are comparisons saying that, you know, this could be worse than the Great Depression when all is said and done. It may even be coming close to that now. We don't really know. But some of the Republicans balked at more relief for the American people because of, well, the debt, the deficit. What do you say to them?
I mean, you know, first of all, you're right. They're complete hypocrites when it comes to this kind of stuff. They always have been. They understand what I think too often Democrats don't understand, which is the deficit is your friend, right? Embrace it. Use it. Don't complain about it. Well, they're complaining about it now because, you know, for political reasons. But you're absolutely right, because in 2017, the end of 2017, in December, the Republicans pushed these massive tax cuts, right? And those tax cuts will end up adding an estimated 1.9, call it 2 trillion to deficits over the course of a decade. Okay, that's the estimated cost. Now, why would Republicans push tax cuts that massively increase deficits, add to the debt, if they genuinely are concerned about these things like burdening the next generation and the dangers of deficits? And the answer is they are genuinely concerned. They understand what the deficit is. And so I think too many people don't understand what the deficit is, and Democrats don't really do a very good job of educating the population. Too often they lean into these myths, and that just reinforces a lot of the bad narratives. So look, the deficit is the difference between two numbers. You say I break stuff down. I can't make it any easier than this. Uh-huh. The deficit is the difference between two numbers. Okay. One of the numbers is how many dollars the government spends into the economy each year. The other number is how many dollars the government swipes back out, subtracts out of the economy, mostly through taxation. Okay, so difference between two numbers. When the government's budget is in deficit, it simply means they're adding more than they're subtracting away. Okay, mm-hmm. So if they spend 100 into the economy and they only tax 90 away, we label it a deficit. We say the government's budget is in deficit. We write a minus 10 on the ledger and we say government deficit. Scary. Wait a minute. If they put 100 in and they only take 90 back out, somebody gets 10, right? Their deficit is nothing more than a financial contribution to some other part of the economy. The question is, for whom? Who got that 10, right? Because when the Republicans did the tax cuts, they know this. They know that their deficit can create a financial windfall for somebody else in the economy. And what they do is use that deficit to deliver the gains right into the hands of the people they're most interested in looking out for. And it turns out those are the people who least need the help in our society, right? The vast majority of the benefits from those tax cuts, some 83% of the benefits of the personal income tax cuts, went to people in the top 1% of the income distribution. Right. So they are channeling that surplus that their deficit creates into the hands of the people they want to have that money. Now look at the CARES Act. Here's a roughly $2 trillion. So they're almost equivalent in terms, right, of the cost of the legislation. But the CARES Act was more strategic about where that money went, to the unemployed, to middle class and low income workers, right, to small businesses. Now, I'm not arguing that every dollar that was spent was strategically placed into the hands of the people who least needed the help, but I'm saying it did a much better job. It prevented some 18 million Americans from slipping into poverty. So it was, you know, a different way of using deficits. But as I like to say, every deficit is good for someone. The question is for whom?
Right. You know, Stephanie Kelton, by the way, you can follow on Twitter at Stephanie Kelton. Very easy. And I do. And I was looking at your Twitter feed yesterday, and Marsha Blackburn, one of the more reprehensible senators on the Republican side of the aisle, tweeted, "Increasing the federal deficit and spending money we do not have will harm our economic recovery." You retweeted that and responded to her. And you said, "Taking a break from grading econ finals to grade this tweet an F. Spending money you don't have is literally how Congress gets money to people who don't have any. Your deficit is our financial surplus. Increasing the deficit will help the recovery." Why don't they understand that? Why doesn't she understand that?
I think she does. I think this is just politics, right? Again, they understand it when they're the ones running the deficit, and those dollars are being channeled into the hands of the people they're looking out for. But God forbid somebody stand up and say we ought to mail checks and provide direct cash assistance to middle class and lower income people. God forbid we say the unemployed ought to have some more time on unemployment to draw unemployment benefits and to have the federal government top those up because it's insufficient. And too many people are going to be, you know, lined up to get food, missing more rent payments, right? Not able to pay their utilities and so forth. So God forbid we stand up and say that. And then all of a sudden the deficit is back in play. Everybody is worried where we can't spend money we don't have. Well, sure we can. That's exactly how it always works. You know, the votes fund the spending. That's where the money comes from. So you remember, Nicole, I know that you remember that back in May, the House passed the HEROES Act.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Yep.
The House passed the HEROES Act. This was $3 trillion plus that the House was prepared to move on. They passed it out of the House. Mitch McConnell wouldn't touch it, right? So the Republicans were not interested at that point in doing more. They were trying to convince themselves that somehow the recovery had taken hold, that the CARES Act did all that was really necessary and the economy was going to recover and we didn't need more fiscal support. Well, the House disagreed and Democrats said, no, we want to do another $3 trillion or so. And what I'm saying is, had the Senate passed that bill, $3 trillion more would have gone out, right? It's the votes that fund the spending. So all of this tweeting by Senator Blackburn and Rand Paul was out there the other day saying we're out of money. We've run out. You know, the cupboards are bare. All of this is just nonsense. The reality is if they will vote for it, it triggers the spending. The money will go out. All you have to do is find the votes. They pretend like we're on a gold standard. They say, how do you find the money? Well, what are you doing? Looking under the seat cushions? Are you looking in a hole in the ground for, you know, some precious metals or something? Like, it doesn't work that
way. They print it, right? That's how it works. We print the money. That's it. Yeah.
I mean, I try not to use that language because it conjures into people's minds images literally of, you know, money being rolled off of the printing
press. Right.
So, you know, this is the modern era after all. So when Congress wrote the CARES Act, that bill was $2.2 trillion, right? And that was Congress writing down a set of instructions that go to its bank. Its bank is the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is the government's fiscal agent. So when Congress passed the CARES Act, what it was doing is effectively saying to the Fed, get ready. We just ordered up $2.2 trillion. You're going to make the payments on behalf of Treasury. We authorized those payments. And the reality is that's where the money comes from. It comes out of the keyboard, really, frankly. It is creating digital dollars. This is the modern era. So when government spends, it results in a credit to a bank account. And this is handled, you know, via keystrokes. I mean, I know it sounds almost fantastical, but that's the reality of modern government finance, and that's where the money is coming from.
Gotcha. So let's look at the big picture. We, the United States of America, believe it or not, we're the wealthiest nation on the planet. including Saudi Arabia and the UAE and all those oil-rich nations, we are the wealthiest nation in the history of the world. And we're being told we can't afford it. Our government, since this pandemic began, in addition to unemployment benefits and things like that, well, people like me can't access that. Self-employed entrepreneurs, allegedly we're supposed to, but here in Florida, it's impossible. And so I've gotten a $1,200 check from the government to help out. One $1,200 check. I look at these charts that are everywhere of what other countries did for their people. Germany, 87% of one salary for the duration. Canada, $2,000 a month to the unemployed. It goes on and on. The UK, 85% of salary. Most countries do this, a percentage of your normal income for the duration. There was somebody, I saw a thing from somebody in New Zealand said, this little country, they've given us $600 a week until we could all go back to work. The United States can't do that. We can. They just choose not to. Is that the bottom line?
Well, okay. So a couple of things. One is it is a little misleading because what the government did in the CARES Act was actually, in some cases, to more than replace, more than 100% of lost income. Right?
For some people,
because
yeah.
You get your state unemployment benefits, and then the federal government came in and said, we're going to give you an extra $600 a week
right.
on top of what you're getting from the state. Now, for some workers, and not a trivial sum, for some workers, that more than made them whole.
Yes.
But for many, many Americans, for the first time in their adult lives, they had enough money at the end of the month. There wasn't a bill that didn't get paid. They could actually cover all of their expenses. And so we did, for many workers, replace not just the lost income, but even a little bit more. So, you know, it depends what you were making before, what kind of job you lost and your replacement rate and so forth. But we did do this, okay? Mm-hmm. In the CARES Act, we did replace, in some cases, 100% or more of lost income. Now we're down to cutting that. The proposal now is to cut that back by 50%, right? To go
right.
to 300 top up from the federal government. That's going to leave a lot of people short. It will put them well below full replacement or 80% of lost wages, as you just showed in some other countries. And when you say, you know, couldn't we do better? The answer is sure we could. Again, if Congress writes the bill, the dollars go out. All they have to do is decide how much, right? How much income support and for how long. And other countries, as you rightly point out, have done a better job. You know, we limited. Everything was kind of contingent on, you know, a period of time, thinking, well, the pandemic's not going to last all that long. You know, we're going to get to the other side. There won't be a second wave. The economy will begin to recover and so forth. And so we underestimated the length of time that we would be fighting this pandemic and the economic fallout that goes with it. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the things timed out, you know, they were set to expire. And that's why we're back where we are.
Right. So we could do it. That's the thing. Now, let me ask the other question about the impact it would have on the economy. If the government were to say, give every citizen $6,000 rather than $600, would it impact inflation or cause like a devaluation of our currency on the world market? Would it be detrimental to our economy or would it be good stimulative?
It's gonna be a good stimulus for those who turn around and spend it. It's gonna be a lifeline. So
yes.
There's this tension between using the term relief and using the term stimulus. Like, right, if you are 6 months behind on your rent and you're about to be evicted and you've got utilities and rent that's been deferred, right? You've been allowed to miss those payments without having your electricity shut off, mm-hmm. without being thrown out of your apartment. But the moratoria is expiring and you owe all of that money. Now, if somebody sends you $6,000, and by the way, it's an interesting number that you chose because we know that there are about 13 million people in this country who are behind, months behind on mm-hmm. rent and utilities. And the average amount that they will owe by January is $5,800.
Wow.
So you hand them $6,000 and they hand it right off in order to, you know, pay those debts that have built up on them. So that's not, I wouldn't call that stimulus. That's a lifeline.
Yeah.
That allows
right.
you to not be homeless, right? And to have the heat on in your place and to have a place to stay during a pandemic. But for some people, it is going to be stimulus because because it's going to be that little bit of extra money that allowed you to go out and make Christmas a reality for the kids, mm-hmm. right? Or to get some new school supplies. And if we're going to have kids back at home, maybe somebody needs a tablet or other sort of, you know, Wi-Fi connectivity or things like that. So there's going to be some of each, that $6,000. The question about inflation is, you know, would that push things too far? Would it be too much to send everyone $6,000? And the only way to know is to run that experiment. But the reality is the economy is so depressed right now that, you know, it seems to me the risk of creating an inflation problem by putting $6,000 into the hands of people, most of whom would turn around, at least many of them, and just stay current on bills. I call that churn. And right. The rest of it might buy some actual goods and services. And that part is stimulus. So, no, I don't think there's a lot of risk associated. If inflation went up, it wouldn't go up a whole lot. And quite frankly, the Fed would probably appreciate some assistance because they can't seem to hit their own 2% inflation target. So they'd like to see inflation move a little bit higher.
Wow. So this is all fascinating. And in fact, I look back to like 2008 and the mortgage crisis. And I'm still, frankly, digging out from that, or not digging. I'm stuck from that. I lost my home back in 2008 during all of that. I lost my job during that. And it's been a rough go ever since. And I think I asked you this once before, but my thought was always, why the hell did we bail out the banks the same amount of money if they had funneled it through people like me, homeowners, and said this money is to be used to pay down your mortgage? It would have gone to the bank, but it would have come through us, and we would have gotten relief in the meantime. I am a layperson. I am not an economist. I know nothing about this, but that seemed to make sense to me. Is there an did it? Does it make sense to you? And is there an analogy here?
Yeah, you know, of course it makes sense. You're absolutely right. The administration did not put its focus on the homeowners in this case. And as a result, millions and millions of people like you lost their homes and have still not recovered from that more than a decade later. Yeah. So tragic, right? This was a crisis driven by fraud in the mortgage market. There's no question about that. So, you know, we could go back and talk about all of the things that lenders and appraisers and rating agencies and did to, you know, create the conditions that allowed the subprime mortgage crisis to develop over time. But, you know, it was based on fraud, and there should have been punishment. People should have gone to jail. There should have been cram downs for the lenders. You know, the mortgages should have been written down. People should have been kept in their homes. I mean, that was the right way to deal with the crisis. We did not do that. Are there lessons here? Yes. I mean, it's Main Street. I think that Democrats have improved in terms of the response to this, that there is, when I talk with, you know, lawmakers, they seem quite sensitive to the, you know, the reality of the backlash. If there's a perception that we're not looking after Main Street again this time, there's going to be a real problem. And so I think that's what you're seeing with so many lawmakers. And it is true that you've gotten, you know, a number of newly elected progressive members of Congress who have pushed some really ambitious legislation in the form of, they don't just want a one-off payment of $2,000. They want recurring payments until the crisis is over. You wouldn't have had anything like that 10 years ago. I don't know where it would have come from, frankly. So there is more sensitivity to, you know, the plight of Main Street and the pain and an understanding. I think, honestly, that if they don't get this right, that the midterms, you're at risk of losing the House, and then you can be, you know, you can look 4 years ahead and say what happens as a party if we don't get this right again.
So I know Bernie Sanders, you know, called on you. You were an advisor when he headed up the Senate Finance Committee. Or was the ranking member of the Senate Finance Committee?
Budget Committee.
Does Joe Biden get this? Does he understand any of this? And has he consulted you at all?
Well, I mean, I served as one of eight members of the task force on the economy. It was the Unity Task Force. I was there at the behest of Senator Sanders, mm-hmm. who chose three people to serve on that committee. And we worked with five members of the task force who were Biden's pick. So eight of us together. And, you know, I worked alongside the economist Eric Hamilton, who's outstanding, and Sarah Nelson, who's, of course, the head of the Flight Attendants Association Union. And so, you know, I'm not exactly sure what you're asking when you say, does he get this, what the this is. But if the question is, do they understand kind of the magnitude of the crisis that they're walking into? I think so. I mean, you will hear President-elect Biden say things like, you know, I walked in with President Obama, the wheels were coming off the economy. It was a complete, you know, crisis situation. And here we are again. And so I think he does understand. And remember, you know, Nicole, he wasn't just talking about a relief package. And he said it again in his remarks yesterday. He's talking about this $900 billion being a down payment.
Right.
He said, come
true.
Back in another month, get ready, because I want to see additional fiscal support. And then beyond that, he's talking about a recovery package. So when FDR was president, you know, he had the three R's. You have relief for the immediate crisis. You have recovery to lay a foundation for, you know, restoring jobs and growth and so forth. And then he had reform, because he wanted to really go at the system and some of the systemic failures. So, you know, President-elect Biden is talking about the recovery part of all of this. And he's talking about, you know, $2 trillion for climate. He's talking about $700 billion for manufacturing. He's talking about $775 billion for education and child care and basically, you know, a care agenda. So that's pretty ambitious.
Yeah.
I have to say, and we'll just have to see how Georgia plays out to see whether, you know, there's any shot at all at, you know, even even getting some of the way there on this kind of stuff.
Right. So it all comes down to January 5th and what happens in Georgia. I asked the question because David Sirota wrote a piece yesterday, Biden's austerity zealotry helped cut the stimulus bill in half. And I know that there's that tendency, and I hope he understands the enormity of it and you know, the theories behind modern monetary theory, actually. So it's wishful thinking, but hopefully he.
Well, no, I mean, you know, you've got people there who are on his economic team. I mean, you know, I know that there were a couple of appointments just last week that were very encouraging to me. I don't want to get anybody in any trouble. These are people who definitely have more than a cursory kind of appreciation of MMT.
Good.
There are, you know, people in the Council of Economic Advisors. Jared Bernstein mm-hmm. was on the task force with us, and I've known Jared for a lot of years. I'm not going to say that Jared is, you know, aligned with MMT. I wouldn't do that to him, but he can speak for himself. But I can tell you that there are plenty of people who have already been named to positions that I think do have a pretty solid understanding. And more than that, they understand that, you know, if this administration is going to be successful, it has to go big, and it cannot do, you know, incremental kinds of things and expect to be successful in the midterms and expect to be successful in 2024. You got to deliver for people. You have to deliver. People have to know not just what you're fighting for, but who you're fighting for. And you've got to stand up and put an agenda out there and fight for an agenda that is clearly a working people's agenda. I mean, the subtitle of the book is Building a People's Economy. This has mm-hmm. It has to be clear to voters every day that you are out there and you are, you're doing every single thing you can to get the votes you need to pass an agenda that's going to materially improve people's lives.
Oh, please. I mean, that's what we need, especially after the 4 years we've just had. In the couple of minutes we have left, I had promoted the fact that you were going to be here today, and I was excited to get some answers. I have a few questions for you, and I'll combine these two. If the defense budget was cut by, say, a third, what effect would the ensuing reduction in troop levels have on the jobs market? And I'll say not only the troop levels, but, contractors, the weapons programs and stuff. That is a socialist job program, is it not, our military budget?
Look, GDP, when we talk about our economy, you know, we usually just use for shorthand our GDP, because our GDP is sort of the way that we measure the economy. Mm-hmm. So look, GDP is just how much money we spend every year buying newly produced goods and services. So anything you do that undermines income, that leads to lower spending in the economy, is going to have detrimental effects on that measure. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't benefits associated with making reductions in certain line items of the budget, but you got to offset that. You've got to replace that lost income and lost spending, or the output doesn't get sold and the economy contracts.
You create jobs in a green economy, in a green New Deal, as it were, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, I am an Air Force brat. My father was in the Air Force. He spent 26 years in the military. We moved all over the place. You know, I remember what happens in a community when a base closes, right? It's mm-hmm. the parlor, and the video used to be a Blockbuster on right. the corner. Now, you know, there's nobody to go there. So it does have implications, right, for reductions in spending. And so it's not to say, you know, it's too dangerous to cut the Pentagon budget. That would be a disaster. No, I'm saying just be mindful that when you make reductions in some part of the budget, you're reducing by reducing your spending, you're reducing someone else's income. And you better have a plan to, you know, that's what we talk about with a Green New Deal,
right?
If you're going to reduce subsidies to fossil fuel companies and you're going to, you know, ban fracking or do these other things, you got to have a plan for the people who are going to become unemployed as a consequence of these sort of things. So you need a jobs program that is aggressive with good wages and benefits, and you can more than compensate.
Right. And that's where the Green New Deal would come in right now. And that sort of steamrolls into the next one, which was what would cutting corporate subsidies do in terms of productivity? Could it cause companies to consider moving more of their operations overseas? Again, if our corporate subsidies have so much of it, I think, is in the way of tax breaks. When you see that Amazon and Google and all these companies don't pay any federal corporate income tax, it's appalling. Can we fix that and save money that way and use it in a more productive manner?
Well, yeah, I mean, yes, the tax code is a mess, and there are all kinds of problems in terms of the way that we incentivize businesses to do business elsewhere and so forth. And that's part of the problem, yes. You know, can we? The thing is, businesses will hire and invest when they're swamped with customers. It's not because we throw them a bone in the form of an extra way to make a tax deduction here and a loophole there, and this is the way to get the so-called job creators, you know, remaining here and creating good-paying jobs for Americans and so forth. They will stay and they will hire and invest in an economy where there is robust demand for the goods and services that they produce. And what that means is you need a middle class that has income, not stagnant income over 30 years, but growing income, right? You need to have consumers for your products. And businesses can stay and be very profitable right here in America, but we've got an income and wealth distribution problem in this country that undermines, right, the ability of the American consumer, which makes up some 70% of total spending in the economy, to actually, you know, buy the products that our companies are looking to produce and sell.
Last question for you, Stephanie Kelton. And I'm worried. I see us going into a deep depression. And if this, if people go about their holiday business as usual, I hate to see what this country is going to look like a month from now. As bad as it is now following Thanksgiving, it's going to be exponentially worse. I live in Florida, where we have a governor that I call, his name is Ron DeSantis. I call him Ron Death Sentence, because he wants everything opened at 100%. He wants bars, schools, everything. No mask mandates. Not a town can't even put in a mask mandate. He's ruled against that. He wants no telemeetings. He wants everything done in person. I mean, he's going against the grain, and our infection rates and death rates are rising. People are going to be out of work. Even worse, the lines for food banks and everything are ridiculous. They're running out of it, out of money, out of food to hand out. I see a Great Depression in our future. Maybe I'm just a pessimist. Do you see a recovery coming? Do you see any end to this? Or what are you, I mean, I know I'm asking you to predict the future, but as an economist, what do you see our standing as? Where do you see us going in the next year?
You know, I wrote a new introduction to the book about 2.5 months ago. And so I did have to do some of this prognosticating, like, where are we going to be? The book is going to publish, I think, on March 9th or 19th or something like
that. Okay, for the paperback. So
there's this new introduction, right? And I wanted it to feel timely, but at the same time, you don't know where you're going to be in March. So much of it depends upon what Congress does, right? Mm-hmm. We staved off a Great Depression-like scenario with the CARES Act and some of the other legislation that was passed in the early part of the pandemic. And then Congress went AWOL, just like they did in 2009, 2010. After the first stimulus package, it was sort of like, hands off. We're not doing any more of this, right? Everybody became preoccupied with the deficit and so forth. And so if we were to get adequate fiscal support, then there's no reason to suppose that the economy has to turn down. You know, we had this bifurcated, uneven recovery. People were describing it as a K-shaped recovery. Where many big corporations and higher income people hardly felt the effects. And in fact,
they're getting richer.
So for them, this was a quick recovery. But for a significant number, tens of millions of workers, this was like a depression already, right? But for the income support that came for the unemployed, and but for that $1,200 check and so forth. So we helped hold it together. We got to the point where it started to look like a recovery, uneven, bifurcated, but still, right? We weren't just spiraling down. Now we are, you know, what time is it? We're right on the cusp of watching the income support expire, the moratoria on the rent and evictions expire. So the situation that I think you envision is consistent with that AWOL sort of, you know, it's like I called it the economic equivalent to the herd immunity response to the pandemic. Yeah. It's the economic equivalent. Just let it go. Let it be. Whoever survives at the end of this, any businesses left standing, anybody who still has a job and an income, well, you know, congratulations, you survived. Everybody else, you know, got wiped out. So there's no reason to let that happen. It doesn't have to happen. But I swear to you that with this latest maneuver, this 11th hour shenanigans that Trump is playing now, does run the very real risk of blowing up a deal, not a good deal, not a great deal, but a deal, right, that at least would have helped some people get through to January.
Right.
Or maybe then we come back and do this again. But, once the defaults start, once the wave of evictions start, and the missed mortgage payments, and the missed car payments, and the missed student loan, and all that debt that's been accruing that comes due and people can't pay, then you have the possibility of this thing bleeding over into the financial system. And then you have not just a health crisis and an economic crisis, but now a financial crisis. And it just, this is what I think.
And a human crisis, because people are going to be homeless and hungry and worse.
A housing crisis, a food crisis. It is the perfect storm. A climate crisis.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
And I purposely didn't ask you about what Trump is doing, because there's no logic to it. There's no rhyme or reason. Nobody, you can't opine on it because it makes no sense. He should have done this months ago and said, you give everybody $2,000 or whatever. But to do it at the 13th hour, which is basically what it is just an insult. It's just to throw more chaos into the mix and screw everything up even more than it already is.
Knife in Mitch McConnell, I think.
That too. And you know what? If that works, good. If it helps Warnock and Ossoff get elected in Georgia on January 5th, please bring it on, because we really need them. Because the only way any of this gets done is if Mitch McConnell is not the Senate Majority Leader. Stephanie Kelton, you're amazing. Thank you so much for joining us. It is Christmas Eve Eve. I know you've got a little one and you want to get on with your holidays. Thank you so much. You're a national treasure. I appreciate you so much. So thank you.
Anytime, Nicole. Happy holidays.
Same to you.
Happy New Year. All right. Take care of yourself.
You too. Bye-bye. Stephanie Kelton, she's so good. I could talk to her for hours, as you could tell. I thank her profusely for the education. Programming note, tomorrow and Friday, I've got special programs planned. They're not recycled things. They're fun music shows, fun Christmassy holiday, both parody songs and real songs, but like cool performances. So you can get it either at NicoleSandler.com/listen-live or at NicoleSandlerStream.com or on the Progressive Voices Network. It'll air. It's audio only. And there is the podcast, too. And it'll be posted on the blog as well. And then Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of next week, we're back here live. And then we'll do the special show thing again Thursday and Friday next week. So have a wonderful weekend. Merry Christmas. Whatever you celebrate. Happy whatever. Stay safe. Stay home. Have a private party. All right. And take care. And I'll see you back here live Monday. But I expect you to listen tomorrow. Bye, everyone.